picks off one, and Engvall back to Sandin. Jason Spezza tees it up, scores his first in November, and the Leafs have five.
That's a bit of the break the slump night, isn't it?
Oh, Lance, that's nice. Coming back with Gordon Lightfoot, reopening Massey Hall tonight in downtown Toronto. I can't tell you how many times I've seen Gordon Lightfoot at that outstage. Dozens of times at Massey Hall. That'll be a special night tonight in downtown Toronto, a special night around the Toronto Maple Leafs. Last night, specifically, a special night for Sean Durzi, albeit in a losing effort. Maple Leafs win. They defeat the Los Angeles Kings last night. 6-2 is the final score. The Maple Leafs have won 7 of their last 8 games. Jim Ralph joins me now, color voice of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Ralphie, how are you today?
Good, Jeff, boy. I've only heard Gordon Lightfoot once live.
You've only seen Gordon Lightfoot once live? Where?
Yeah, it was, I believe, the club downtown. It was called the Cambridge Club. It might still be there. It's a workout club, the Sheraton Hotel.
Oh,
and,
nice.
And I was asked to come and speak. They had their annual night, whatever it was. So it was just 200 guys in tuxedos, just guys. And they had the bar covered up with plywood, and you stood on the bar. It was the stage. But anyway, Gordon Lightfoot was a member there. He might still be. Mm-hmm. And he got up and sang a few songs first, and then I got up after, and I said, I've got mixed emotions about this. I said, on one hand, I'm standing on a piece of plywood on a bar in front of 300 guys in tuxedos. I said, on the other hand, I said, Gordon Lightfoot just opened for me.
Now, are you a fan, Ralphie?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big time. Yeah, Sundown. And even the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, I remember playing, we were playing midget hockey in Sault Ste. Marie, and the lights went out that night, and the rest of the game was canceled. So, yeah, I'm a huge fan of Mr. Lightfoot.
Just haunting, you know, haunting melodies, haunting songs that'll be with us forever. I'll tell you what, sun not going down on the Maple Leafs right now for a strange tie-in for this game from last night. Sun very much up. 6-2 is the final score. Rasmus Sandin with 3 assists. Jack Campbell with 30 saves. The Kings have lost 5 in a row. The Maple Leafs have won 7 of their last 8. What stood out for you last night, Jim?
I think it's, you know, the same as the Islander game. It was all four lines were going. Mm-hmm. You know, this time you had, you know, Spezza scoring with the second power play unit. You had finally Pierre Engvall, who opened the scoring for the Leafs in the opener against Montreal. You know, he finally finds the back of the net again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see Wayne Simmonds, you know, since he sat the game in Buffalo, was a healthy scratch. I think he's been fantastic, you know, in 9 to 11 minutes a game. He's been very noticeable. And, you know, that fourth line seems to spend a lot of time in the offensive zone, which is exactly what you need.
Yeah, he's been good. Spezza, like the thing that I love about Spezza is that the way he scores goals is almost a reminder of the way hockey used to be played in some respects, Jim. Like, who comes in like Spezza and rips a slap shot? I mean, that used to be standard. I mean, Jim, we would see it all the time. You were a goaltender. You saw it all the time as well. A guy just stepping in and, you know, back scratching with his hockey stick. You don't see that anymore. Like, I know that one day Jason Spezza is going to call it a career. But right now I love him because I look at the plays and they look like old school plays. They still work. I look at the goals last night, just coming in very basic, comes in and rips a slap shot and scores. And it still works. What's your thoughts on Jason Spezza at the age of 38, still productive, still in the NHL and reminding us how hockey used to be played?
Well, and you know what it is? He still handles the puck so well. You know, I remember talking, I think it was Stevie Thomas was saying that it's not the legs that go first, it's the hands. And for Jason Spezza, you know, the hands are still there. He's still making plays, and you just love the fact that it's a shoot-first mentality. Now, without Nick Ritchie in front of Jonathan Quick, it's probably...
Great screen.
It's probably, you know, may not be the goal that it ended up being, but you just sort of like that mentality. I mean, they get, you know, usually 20 to 30 seconds at the second part of a power play, and it always seems that Jason Spezza is the dangerous guy. you know, whether it's trying to make a pass or, but, you know, it's just, you can tell the mind is still the same as it was when he was 20 and coming up, how he sees the ice and how he's able to develop plays because of that.
You know, I always, I mean, you've talked to Jason Spezza plenty. I'm sure you get the same feeling that whenever it is over for Jason Spezza on the ice, he's someone that wants to stay in the game in some capacity, front office, behind the bench. I don't get the feeling that Jason Spezza is going to be one of those guys, you know, that just sails off into the sunset and we ask, you know, whatever happened to Jason Spezza? I kind of get the feeling that he's going to be around hockey for a long time. Do you get that same feeling, Jim?
Well, yeah, and especially when you look at why he's in Toronto. It's, you know, league minimum because he wants to play here. You know, it's for the passion for the game, passion for, you know, the Maple Leaf uniform. So, yeah, I'm with you on that. The funny thing is, the first time I ever met him, he was 15, and I sat beside him at the Conn Smythe dinner in Toronto. And I still don't think he remembers it that well. But I remember hearing about this kid that was coming up. And then a few years later, I sat with John Tavares at the same thing when he was 15. And I remember trying to have an adult conversation with him and realizing he's a year younger than my daughter, who I would never have a conversation like this with. So it's funny how it comes back full circle. But yeah, for Jason Spezza, there's something special. Even I know a lot of people will bring up when they lost the series to Columbus in the bubble in August of 2020, him fighting to try to get the team some sort of emotional jump. And it's hard not to admire that. It's almost as if the points or the goals and everything else, that's bonus territory.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the goaltending. Jack Campbell. So later on in the show, Maddie Marchese, my producer, and I are going to go through like, okay, here we are a quarter of the way through the season. Hart, Norris, Calder, Adams. And when we do the Vezina, you know, I've got it down to a few. Jacob Markstrom, Igor Shesterkin, Sergei Bobrovsky, Freddie Anderson. Robin Lehner is kind of a low-key candidate here as well. And also Jack Campbell. And I'll tell you, Jim, Jack Campbell is pretty high amongst all those goaltenders. How do you see him right now in the kaleidoscope of goalies in the NHL that you've seen?
Well, you know, I think what was great was last night, I think with about 3 minutes left in the period, LA had only three shots on goal. Mm-hmm. So you think, you know, this is a pretty easy period for him, and they ended up with 10. You know, he had that barrage late when LA had some pressure. And I'm not making a direct comparison between the 78 Canadians and the, the, you know, 2020 Leafs, but what Ken Dryden used to do, he'd face 17 to 20 shots. But he would always make one or two saves at the key moment that kept the other team from getting any kind of momentum or getting excited about the game. And I think that's where Campbell has settled in now, where the good thing is we're not talking 40 to 50 shots a night where he's got to stand on his head and he's going to be the first star. They've protected him pretty well, but when they need that big save at the right time, he seems to be able to deliver it for them. I don't think it can be understated the chemistry he seems to have with his teammates, how guys want to play hard for him. And I think that's pretty evident when you see after every win or after every save or somebody blocks a shot in front of him and he's out tapping shin pads. And, you know, there really seems to be a perfect marriage right now between him and the way the team plays defensively.
You know, one of the interesting things about the Maple Leafs is everybody makes a lot about the big four and the contracts, and they haven't, you know, allocated enough for the blue line. But, you know, last time I checked, the way the Maple Leafs have, you know, snapped out of their funk at the beginning of the season was tightening up defensively. I still see that, like, right now, and again, we're all sort of waiting. There are some teams that they just can't wait to get to the playoffs because that's where they're going to be judged. Regular season, in a lot of ways, doesn't mean anything, but getting there is another process. And I look at this team and I say, this is a really good defensive team. And it's not just because they have a couple of good blue liners. It's a good defensive team with the accent on team, more so than anything else. How do you see this squad as a defensive squad?
Well, I think the first goal last night was probably the most telling. You know, Wayne Simmonds wins a battle in his own zone, and off they go. And if you don't have five guys deep, or if you had somebody flying the zone early, you know, chances are there's a turnover and you're in trouble in your own end. So That's what I like about it. It seems, and I'm not going to say that the top four is sacrificing offense for defense, but you see even the top two lines are back battling. You know, there's not a lot of cheating, even in close games. And I thought even though they scored six last night, I think what they've stayed away from is if they're up two, it used to be they wanted to be up six. You know, and they sort of forget the defensive side, and it was like, let's go. They've got a pinch. They've got a force. Let's catch them off guard. They seem to be a very comfortable team heading into the third period, scoreless or up 1-0, which to me is pretty interesting because that hasn't been the norm in a long time in the Leafs.
Do you have a thought on Rasmus Sandin? Here he is last night, 3 assists as, you know, they're waiting for, you know, younger players to emerge. Rasmus Sandin was the first ever draft pick with Kyle Dubas as the full-time lone general manager on the squad. It may have taken a few years, but are you prepared to say that Rasmus Sandin is here, period?
Where do you play junior again?
Sault Ste. Marie, sir. Sault Ste.
Marie. He's here for good. Yeah, Michael Mario didn't play for the Sioux, but at least, you know, he had that connection. Actually, you know, my brother was on the police force with in the Sioux with Kyle's father for years. I played with Kyle's dad and his uncle Walter for years growing up in the Sioux. So, I know the fan support he's got back there. But, yeah, I think, you know, even though, you know, Sandin's eventually got to be, you know, obviously a top four guy. I don't want to make a lot of comparisons to Thomas Caberle, but it's, he sees the game exceptionally well. He's not overly physical, and that's why I think when you look at Sandin and Liljegren, they're not your typical 5-6 guys. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more skill puck moving as opposed to lumbering, shut down physical. But yeah, you're starting to see. It seems like every 2 weeks there seems to be another level that he's achieved in his game, and you know, the Leafs are going to need it. And you know, until we start talking about salary cap issues again.
Now, what do you make of Liljegren here?
Of Liljegren?
Yeah, what do you make of Liljegren?
Yeah, I thought he was good last night too. You know, he can make some neat little plays, little curls in his own end, and take his time to get it out. You do see sometimes he gets a little overmatched physically, and I think it was a game in Carolina. Where, you know, there was a race back to his own net, and he lost the battle, and then the Hurricanes scored. But, you know, that usually when you see younger guys, defensemen especially, they start to put on weight and you know, grow into the role a little more as opposed to forwards that can get away with it with speed. So I think they've been a nice compliment. And, you know, I don't think you're going to go through a whole season without him being a healthy scratch at times. I think just to sort of rest them up and get other guys in the lineup. But again, I think there's nice chemistry with two guys that came up in the Marlies together.
So the Maple Leafs are on the California tour right now. They beat the Los Angeles Kings 6-2, San Jose next on the horizon. And then even though they've had a little bit of a dip in result the past few games, a really tough Anaheim Ducks team, a team that's a lot better than we thought they were going to be at the beginning of the season. What did you think of the Kings last night? And specifically, do you have a thought on, man, the guy must have just been full of energy, and you saw when he got the rookie lap. Do you have a thought on Sean Durzi from last night?
Yeah, I noticed him the most, I think, Jeff, in the second period, where he was pinching a lot down the right wing boards. And, you know, that's confidence, because a lot of times a defenseman will come up and all you want to do is not be noticed. Like, don't make a mistake, don't gamble. And the pinches were great. You know, the Kings a couple of times had, you know, good pressure in the Leafs zone because of, you know, him pinching and being able to keep the puck in. So that you almost felt bad for him that he scores to make it 6-2. So you can't really celebrate your first NHL goal. It'd be like a goalie winning 8-7 in his first NHL start. You're going, okay, yeah, it was nice to get the W, but you know, I hope I get another shot to lower the average a bit.
it's so true, because you have to do that sort of, you know, performative moment where you have to pretend like you're not excited, because but you just know that inside the kid's just I mean, I guess that's one of the things that I guess sports dictates it, but I just would have loved for the kid to really express how he felt in that moment, regardless of the score. I know everyone's got to do the big performance. Oh, would rather have had the 2 points in the first goal. No, I'm not. You know, I was born at night, but not last night. That's a great moment for that kid.
and it wasn't one of those wrist shots that had seen eyes. I mean, it was a skilled play.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about Jason Spezza taking up extra ice in the power play. The kid did the same thing, just sifted into the slot and, you know, the perfect video game goal crossbarred in.
Yeah, skilled goal by a skilled player. Jim, it's been a lot of fun, as always. We'll see what happens. San Jose's not an easy touch. Neither is Anaheim. Those are the next two on the board for the Maple Leafs. We'll see how they fare. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.
There he is, Jim Ralph, color analyst for the Toronto Maple Leafs on radio alongside Joe Bowen. Leafs win 6-2 last night against the Los Angeles Kings. Rasmus Sandin with 3 assists. Sean Durzi with 1-1. Jack Campbell with 30 saves. I mentioned a little bit later on, Maddie and I are going to go through some of the awards at the quarter mark of the season. So we'll do the Hart, we'll do the Vezina, we'll do the Norris, we're going to do the Calder. Although right now there's one player specifically just running away with it, but I've got someone that I think may make some noise by the end of all of this. And hint, it's not Sider, it's not Mercer, it's not Zegras either. But there's one player out there that I think may have a shot at the Calder. That seems to be Lucas Raymond's right now to lose. And another nice goal yesterday by Lucas Raymond as the Red Wings stunned the St. Louis Blues. Am I allowed to say that it's fun to watch the Red Wings now? Is that okay? Can I sort of, you know, as I peer around the corner, is that okay if I mention that Detroit's kind of a fun team to watch all of a sudden last night? And Robbie Fabry was playing real good last night as well. Is it okay to say that it's fun to watch the Red Wings? Dylan Larkin was awesome last night for the Wings. That was another really good performance. We'll do the Adams as well. And there's no shortage of candidates for the Jack Adams a quarter of the way in. And I'm sure I'll leave some names out. But I'm looking at people like Dallas Eakins of Anaheim right now, Mike Sullivan of Pittsburgh, Daryl Sutter in Calgary, Rod Brind'Amour in Carolina, Sheldon Keefe in Toronto, Dean Evason in Minnesota. There are others. Those are the ones that jump to my mind right away. We'll do that coming up in hour two. If we get time, we'll do our surprises of the season so far and our biggest disappointments of the season so far. So that's coming up in hour two. Also, in hour two, we will talk to Bruce Stobigan, the author of In Exact Science, the 6 most compelling draft years in NHL history. If you've ever heard me on this platform, podcast, TV, wherever, you know I'm in love with the alternative universe of the NHL. Like if the Thornton to Florida for Luongo trade would have happened as once proposed once upon a time, what is the future of the league and those two players? Things like that. This book talks about that, but from a draft point of view. We'll start by talking about 71. And what if Montreal had taken Marcel Dion instead of Guy Lafleur? Hit a break. More Merrick Show across the Sportsnet Radio Network in a couple of moments. Keep it here. Back of the program. Welcome to hour two. I may want to go right to page 127, The Great Refusal, 1991, with our next guest dealing with his next book, In Exact Science, the 6 most compelling draft years in NHL history, written by Evan and Bruce Dobigan. Bruce, my guest now. Bruce, how are you today?
I'm good, Jeff. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I've always wanted to write a book like this, and I've always wanted to read a book like this. And the wonderful thing about this book is you can still write about a dozen more like it. I think that, and you can write one about every draft, really, and then write one, you know, looking 10 years out. It is just such fertile ground when you deal with, you know, things like the stories behind the draft pick, stories behind the draft, and the alternative universe, the what if, and the what ifs around the NHL draft. Before we get to some of the more specific stories, I want to jump in with Dion versus LaFleur 71. Why this one? Why did this pique your interest?
Well, all of the books, all of the years we chose for the book, the hardest part was cutting down and figuring out which ones we wanted. Because as you just said, you could write 30. You could choose 30 drafts. They all have something interesting about them. The reason we chose this one is that even though the Gilbert Perreault draft had been the year before, the first kind of universal draft with a top pick, et cetera, and Gilbert was obviously worth having, we felt like this is the year that Sammy Pollock made the draft an important thing. This was the year in which Sammy Pollock showed you how by trading around, trading for draft picks, moving around in the draft, you could create a great team. And obviously this year, the thing that we found out that we didn't know going in was, of course, the battle between LaFleur and Dion, the two French-Canadian kids, who was going to be number one. It looked pretty sure that it was going to be LaFleur for a long time. And as you know, Sammy Pollock was able to get that first-round draft pick from the Oakland Seals. So the Canadians win the Stanley Cup with Ken Dryden in net, and then they get to turn around and have this first-round draft pick. But the thing we didn't know was that basically Sammy had a trade in place for the number two pick. He was poised to take Marcel Dion with the second pick. He was going to give up Terry Harper, I think Phil Mir, and a bag of pucks or something to the Red Wings. And he went to his scouting department and said, do you think we should do this? And he didn't get a unanimous yes on it, and so they didn't go ahead and do it. But it's a great year. LaFleur, a great player. But as I say, the legacy of it is just what it taught us about the draft and the importance of it.
Did you get a thought, and listen, Sam Pollock, as general manager, was one of the first that understood the value of this draft. You know, I also want to throw, you know, the bow tie from Long Island in as well. I think that Bill Torrey got it right away. I'll tell you what, Bruce, one of the things, and this is my white whale, I swear. I remember I asked him about it a number of times. He would never give it up. I've talked to a lot of people around and they were able to find out. And this is one of the things, that I believe he took to his grave. Would you know, in your years of experience, what exactly the Montreal Canadiens offered him for the first overall pick that turned out to be Dennis Potvin?
We asked some people, and unfortunately, of course, all of the principals have all left us and passed away. So it's hard to get a first person on it. The Canadiens, from all I can find out, is the Canadiens basically gave him a list of about six players and told him that he could choose three of them or something, three or four perhaps. Who they were, we don't know. But the thing about Torrey, and you're mentioning him, well, you can also mention, of course, Cliff Fletcher. These guys were all disciples of Sam Pollock's. They learned at his knee. So when it comes to Sam phones you up, and you're Bill Torrey, and you've seen how he's done things in the past. You know what? You know what's going on. You don't have to be told not to jump at anything that Sam Pollock is offering you. But it was, you know, in those days, again, there were still lots of franchises who were willing to trade a first-round pick to get something the next year so the fans wouldn't rebel. And Bill Torrey had some lousy years with the Islanders before they became a dynasty, and he had the discipline to do that. It wasn't necessarily a drafting, but my other favorite thing about Bill Torrey, of course, is signing Denny Potvin's brother to come and play for the team, just to give him a little bit of a comfort factor. Those are the kind of inside stories I like.
Well, I mean, because there was very much the lure and the tug of the WHA at that point, and I think that Potvin's rights were held by Edmonton of the WHA, and there was some thought, as the WHA was competing for contracts, as you well know, that Potvin might go for a more lucrative contract in the WHA, so they made a trade and brought in his brother, made a trade with the Philadelphia Flyers. Terry Crisp would have been the principal there. He goes to the Flyers, and the Pot fan, Jean Pot fan, goes the other way. It is a remarkable story. But you know what? See, so I'm reading the part on 71 specific. I love the 70s stuff because you can read a lot into the personalities of the general managers, and it seemed like much more so than today, where it's much more cooperative, and you know nobody wants to rip anybody off. And back then, guys were Brian Burke would always refer to them as pirates, like GMs were pirates. Like if you shook Sam Pollock's hand, you better count your fingers after. Like, and there were a lot of guys that were like that, right, Bruce?
It was a different culture, and it was there wasn't as much money in the business. There hardly was any money in the business, even if you were the guy running the team. So it wasn't like you could do a 5-year contract as a GM and then retire, do like Mike Gillis did, where he did 6 years with the Canucks and he didn't have to work again. Those things didn't exist. So you had to take advantage of whatever you had at the time. And if you were able, the classic example, of course, is who was it he made the trade with the Oakland Seals to get the number one draft pick overall? Well, of course, it was Frank Selke Jr. And and Pollock, had, of course, he learned his stuff at the knee of Frank Selke Sr. Frank Selke Jr. had been around the Canadiens for a long time. He was a guy everybody knew, and I'm sure Sammy knew him on a first-hand basis. But when it came time to take advantage of him, hey, listen, we got to do what we got to do.
It's just business, I'm afraid. It's just business. The book is called Inexact Science, The 6 Most Compelling Draft Years in NHL History. 1979 is a pivotal year as well. Why in the draft?
Well, I think you can make an argument that it's one of the two or three best years in terms of players coming into the league. But it's the significance of it for us, of course, is that's the year that Wayne Gretzky dodges the draft. Yes. You were just mentioning about the Edmonton Oilers. Of course, they obtained his contract from Indianapolis to the WHA. Peter Pocklington was smart enough to put Wayne on the personal services contract. So he went to the NHL, and he said to the NHL, if you want Wayne Gretzky playing in your league this year, you've got to deal with me. You've got to put the Edmonton Oilers into the NHL as part of the merger. And, of course, he did that. And Wayne was, as part of the trade, Wayne was never going to be exposed to anyone else. I think Denver had the first overall pick. Obviously, they didn't get him. They got Barry Beck. But what's interesting about it, of course, is that Gretz comes into the league and he's under 20. And in those days, of course, you couldn't be drafted till you were 20. And what happened for that draft was, okay, the NHL says, we're going to say it's good to have Gretzky in the league. Now we've got to let all the 18, 19, and 20-year-olds who would have been drafted before but weren't because of our old rules, we've got to let them be available. And if you look at the list of players who came out of that draft, and they only had 6 rounds because of the merger, it was a little late in the season, they didn't do a full draft, but they had 6 rounds. You look at the guys who were drafted and the guys who were signed, it's just stunning. You look at the Oilers alone, of course, they get Mark Messier, they get Kevin Lowe, they get Glenn Anderson, they get the core of their team moving forward. But right across the league, players, teams get Hall of Fame players from this kind of nuance in which 3 years of drafting all in 1 year.
Yeah, it really is remarkable. I know there's a lot of people there is an anti-Gretzky camp that's out there and an anti-Sather, anti-Oiler camp that always point to 1979 that you document here in your book in Chapter 2 that, he was never subject to the draft, so how is this quote-unquote fair? Like there is that camp that I'm sure you've spoken to plenty of people that are very much in that anti-99, anti-Glenn Sather, anti-Oilers camp that have said, hang on a second. Here, this is not as legitimate as the Islanders dynasty that was built quote unquote the proper way, or the recent Habs dynasty that was quote unquote built the right way. Yeah, I'm sure you've talked to these people.
Yeah, but this is also the spirit that we get pretty soon in the third chapter. Of course, is 84 about how Mario drives the hard bargain with the Penguins, and of course Eric Lindros in 91 how he does his whole thing where he basically forces a trade, etc. The great ones have been able to get special consideration when it came to the draft, at least at that time. And it's also hard for people who are around today with the stability of the league to remember just how fly-by-night a lot of stuff was. The WHA is collapsing. There's all sorts of NHL teams who are in dire financial straits, etc. People are desperate to get this thing done. Let's get one league. Let's get this thing, in a way that financially we can manage going forward. And so people were willing to do, little deals on the side. And you've got to give Pocklington, speaking of pirates, a lot of credit for having the foresight to say, personal services contract. And yeah, again, if you were in Denver, you would have Colorado Rockies, you would have had Gretz there. And I can see why they're bitter. But Barry Beck was a decent player. It's not like they got the worst player in the league. But anyway, it's one of the reasons we chose some of the years we did again is because they were exceptional. They weren't just, you know, Connor McDavid at the top of the draft. There you go. The Sid Crosby draft in 2005, of course, the Penguins, they just got the luck of the balls bouncing their way. I mean, it could have gone almost any other way, and yet the Penguins got him, and that's what fascinated us about it. And then other people in the draft. What we do with each chapter, by the way, for people, hopefully everybody gets a chance to read it, but we show the draft, the first round as it was drafted, then we redraft it at the end of the chapter, how it would have gone, knowing what we know today.
Yeah, you have Nicholas Lidstrom becoming a member of the Quebec Nordiques, and Sergei Fedorov is all of a sudden a New York Islander. Like the redrafts are general managers hate them, but for guys like you and me and everybody else, the redraft is always a lot of fun. You know, that's interesting. In that Sidney Crosby draft, you know, there's always I've talked to Ron McLean about this a couple of different times and other people as well. You know, there was a moment where the general managers and the owners are in a ballroom and we're watching the lottery balls fall, and it's between, say, Craig Patrick is there for the Pittsburgh Penguins and Brian Burke is there for the Anaheim Ducks, and the Pittsburgh Penguins end up with the first lottery ball. Do you remember what Bill Wirtz started saying, like really loud over everybody? Do you remember this story at all?
No.
It's a very tiny story.
So. I was listening on the radio. I didn't see it, so I was listening on the radio.
Again, we talk about, you know, white whales and trying to find out, like, you know, who Pollock was offering for Dennis Potvin. All of a sudden, Bill Wirtz starts saying, justice, justice, justice. And I have asked everybody. I've asked people in the Hawks organization, people that were there. What did Bill Wirtz mean when the Pittsburgh Penguins won the lottery in 2005 to get Sidney Crosby? Why is he saying above everybody else in the room, justice? I have no idea. That's one of the ones
that he was just referring to David Justice, the baseball player. He was just having a seniors moment. I don't know, honestly.
He's just ordering a scotch, and he's just saying, not saying justice, he's saying just ice with it. That might have been it.
That would have been Bill. And again, think of the Penguins. Both times they hit the home run in the draft. Both times the franchise is like on life support. 84, the team is. You know, the rumors were going to Hamilton, et cetera. And, of course, they get Mario and everything turns around. They had three first-round draft picks that year. Of course, Doug Bodger was the second. I'm sure you know who the third one was, not a well-known guy. Do you know who the third one was for the Penguins then?
Sorry, which year would this have been?
84, the Mario draft.
Oh, the Mario draft. So first is Mario. So who was second round?
Oh, they had three picks in the first round. They had Bodger was the second first round pick, and they had another one in the first round. The Pride of St. Catharines, Ontario.
Was it Rod Buskus, was it?
No, it was Roger Belanger, who came and went.
Oh, my goodness. Roger
I ended
Belanger.
Up doing some stories with Roger. Unfortunately, things went badly in his career. I did some stuff on him. But anyhow, three first round picks. But anyhow, the Penguins get the life saving they need. And then once again in 2005, you know, things financially are pretty dicey. Mario's got all of his money invested in the team. They need this other break. And then in consecutive years, of course, they managed to get Malkin. They managed to get Sid. They managed to rebuild the team and become a great team again. No team has been as blessed as the Penguins have been by the draft and the timing of the draft. So when the word said justice, it can't be the Penguins didn't need justice again. There's some other teams that could use a lot more than them.
It's the opposite of what's happened to the Vancouver Canucks at various drafts. Even going back to that first one, you referenced the Gilbert Perreault draft in 1970, where they ended up getting Dale Talon instead of the head of the French Connection there. Now, the Lindros draft is an interesting one, and that's one that we can continue to revisit. And that is, you know, talking about fertile ground. That one's like that ground is soft. You can plant a lot of seeds in there and they will all find roots and they will all sprout and they will all, you know, provide fruit eventually. Here we are in, you know, what is it? November the 25th. 2021, as you look back to the Lindros draft, after going through it, that was a draft that led to the trade call, because we had both the Rangers and the Philadelphia Flyers saying that, no, hold on a second here. We had, you know, we had a deal in place for this player. How do you look at that draft now, you know, so many years later?
Well, what was interesting was at that time I was the sports anchor for CBC in Toronto. And obviously the thing was about Lindros. He was the star. And where was he going to go? Would he go to Quebec, not go to Quebec? But the thing that fascinated me that entire year leading up to the draft was, of course, what the Maple Leafs had done in trading away their top pick to get their hands on Tom Kervers. You remember they had that season where it looked like things had turned around and they just needed a good puck-moving defenseman. They trade the first-round pick. Of course, the next year goes completely sideways. And for a good part of the season, it looks like the Maple Leafs have basically lost the chance at getting Eric Lindros. Now, by the end of it, of course, they improved a little bit, and they didn't necessarily miss out on him. But, of course, who did they miss out on? They missed out on Scott Niedermayer. And all of the attention being put on Lindros, this story kind of outside of Toronto goes by. People don't understand what was going on in Toronto and the panic in the Toronto hockey community. We're going to watch Lindros come in here and beat us for a generation because we traded for Tom Kervis.
So here's my thought on this. I've thought about this one a lot. You know who made the mistake there? Because you can understand what the Toronto Maple Leafs were trying to do at that point. Now it blew up in their face. However, you know who I look at there as making one of the big mistakes is San Jose. So San Jose selects second. Like, I'm sure if you ask like common Maple Leafs fans, they'll say, oh, Niedermayer must have went second. No, San Jose drafted second. The mistake was they took Pat Falloon instead of Scott Niedermayer. Like, if Falloon falls to three and New Jersey ends up taking Pat Falloon, it's a lot more of a soft landing for the Maple Leafs in their trade when you say, well, we traded Kervers for Falloon instead of Kervers for Niedermayer. Yeah. I always thought that was San Jose was the mistake. Yeah, I know. It's in exact science. Yeah.
Yeah, we talk about it in the book, and I at this point I've got to say that, you know, I co-wrote this with my son, but the bulk of the research and writing stuff was him. He works he does the Sports Center at another network. I can't talk about it.
The evil telecom.
Yeah, he does that, and it was fun working with him. And I've done 10 books, 8 hockey books, and every time I have a hockey book, Evan has always been my researcher. He's absolutely the guy.
He's
the go-to guy. And in this book, this research, this knowledge is so much of him. So I just have to say I'm giving credit to my son. So much fun to work with your own son and to have him be really good at this type of thing. So that was fun. And we go on about Pat Falloon, who got the unfortunate nickname of Fat Balloon eventually because he had some issues with staying in shape. And just, you know, one of those ones that the second round draft picks, we also looked at that over the course of the book. We didn't do a lot on it. But the second round picks, and you mentioned Talon, just what happens to them? That'd be a whole book alone, because you'd think that if they're marginally, you know, it's only marginally not as good as the first round pick, they must have had great careers. So few of them do.
Mm-hmm. You know what's, I'll tell you what. So 91 is Lindros. And then 1992 is a fascinating draft. And I remember having, this is when, actually, I think it might have been when I was in Quebec doing the Memorial Cup a few years ago at the shutting down of the Colisée. And I was working with Todd Warner. We were out for a run, and we were talking about his draft. And, you know, there was a chance throughout the year. He was playing for the Windsor Spitfires. There was a chance he was going to go first overall. Ended up being Roman Hamrlick. He goes to Tampa. Alexei Yashin's second. Mike Rathje goes to San Jose third. And Todd Warner goes fourth to the Quebec Nordiques. And Don Meehan was his agent. And so he gets called up fourth, and he goes up, and he puts on the Quebec Nordiques jersey. And the place erupts in Montreal. They start going crazy for Todd Warner. And he's like, well, why is everyone like going crazy for me doing that? He couldn't figure it out. And he went off stage. And his agent's like, you don't understand this, do you? And Todd says, no, I don't. And he says, last year, Eric Lindros refused to put on that jersey. You're an Anglophone putting on that jersey. They're going crazy for you right now. They're loving you. He goes, oh, my God, it didn't even dawn on me that was a thing. But when Warner put on the Nords jersey, the place erupted, like Bruce, like the cork out of a champagne bottle.
And the other thing to remember about 91, 92 is this is also the point at which the NHL Players Association becomes a real union. It was 91, 92 when Allen Eagleson finally got punted sideways. The guy who had basically, you know, fraudulently deceived the players for 25 years. And you finally get Bob Goodnow in, and we have a real Players Association that intends to emulate the Major League Baseball Players Association, how it protects its guys, et cetera. So it's really important that at that point, not just that the union gets some self-respect, but that Lindros shows the power that a player in his position can have, how he can use that power to get what he wants, et cetera. And today we're used to all the free agent fireworks in various sports and how these things happen. But in that one in particular, it was a sign that it wasn't business as usual in the NHL anymore, that the players now certainly have some leverage that they didn't have in the past. And it's just a quick story. I was very supportive of the Lindroses in doing what they were doing. I said, yeah, use your hammer. You're a family. Use the hammer, et cetera.
Yeah.
I wrote a book years later called Money Players about the lockout year and basically the union history of the NHL. And I tried to do an interview with the Lindroses about that sequence because I wanted their part of it. No, we're not going to talk to you. Not going to talk to you. So we do the book, and I've talked to a bunch of other people for it. And I get a call from Bonnie Lindros, and she's mad at me. And I'm going, oh, what's the matter? Oh, you got it all wrong. And I said, well, what do you mean I got it all wrong? I talked to all the other people in the room. Well, you said the phone was black, but it was a white phone we were standing around. I'm going like, oh, my goodness. Dealing with the Lindros family. You know, honestly, I asked you to participate in the book. You didn't. And now you're complaining about the color of the phone in the cottage where you waited to find out whether it was Philadelphia or New York. It was just amazing.
You know, that entire situation, there is a standard way for players to behave around the draft, and that is, you know, just shut up and put on the jersey and the baseball hat and yep. go where you're told to go, and that's always the way it's been done. Lindros was interesting because Lindros and that family, as you well know, like, it wasn't exactly a secret that the Quebec Nordiques were going to be sold, and if they yep. had someone like Eric Lindros, that would probably add $50 million to the price tag, and he wasn't interested in being part of that.
Yeah,
I looked at that and I said, you know what, like at the time, like, you're just thinking traditional, you know, hockey sense, like, oh, come on, kid, like, that's the way everybody else does it. But then you sort of take a, you know, stand back and take a more sober look at it, and you say, you know what, good for him, good for Lindros. Yeah.
Well, one of the things I talk about a lot now, I live in Alberta, obviously, is just how much longer Connor McDavid stays in Edmonton if they can't become a good team. How can you become the signature player in the league if you're not playing important games, if you're not playing games that matter? You're missing the playoffs, or you're going out very early in the playoffs. If I'm him, and listen, you're not generating a lot of brand recognition from out of Edmonton. If I'm him, I'm thinking like the Lindroses did, that I want to get to a market that has I can grow my brand. Lindros helped them. The Lindros family helped Philadelphia build that stadium. He helped the Snyders build that stadium. He was the kind of the lure that got a lot of the money freed up so that they could build that stadium. So, I always wonder about these guys and whether they have their, you know, whether they use their hammer the way they can use it. The Lindros is dead, and I didn't have a problem with it at the time. It was something that needed to be done. And let's be honest about the other thing, that people say, oh, you're anti-French. I think a large part of that was that they were really, really put off by Marcel Aubut. And Marcel.
I believe that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe that.
He's a walking carnival of noise, et cetera. And there were always stories then which came out later about his personal behavior, et cetera. And I think they just didn't want him to be around him or have their son's future in his hands. And I think that was a large part. They never said it that way. And mm-hmm. and they could have maybe said it that way. But I don't think it was anti-French. They didn't want the market, and they certainly didn't want Marcel.
You know, one of the I want to go back to the Crosby draft here, the 2005 draft. To me, that was the most interesting lottery because everybody was involved in it. Everybody had a shot at it. My thought on a lot of this is, like, this is a multi-capped league. You know, there are salary caps within salary caps. It's all about how you manage your resources, use your resources, and choose to spend your money. I'm very much in the camp of everybody should be involved in every lottery, not just the teams that don't make the playoffs. How do you feel about it? Because this is, you know, we're talking about the draft. That's a big part of your book in Exact Science. Yep. How do you feel about that 2005 draft?
Well, first of all, I was very much supportive of the hockey guys when the NHLPA not getting a salary cap. I thought it would be a bad thing for them. I think the time has proven that it's been a real drag on the top players in the league. I don't think it's really helped. It's done the things it was supposed to. So I was a little put off the fact that they had given up and had allowed the salary cap to happen and change things. The 2005 draft and how these drafts happen, I've played with a couple of formulas over the years. One of the formulas I like is that all the teams who don't make the playoffs get into a pool. And then you do the what's-the-name balls. Everybody else goes in sequence, and then you take the teams on the bottom. So that it gives an incentive for teams to play hard right till the end. That's what I wrote about this in a previous book about salary caps called Cap in Hand, in which I advocate for going to the British soccer model for how to run your business. But there has to be an incentive at the end of the year for teams to play. And you know this. You have to talk about games, and you know exactly what's going on, which is management doesn't want to win. They don't want, you know, they're finding ways to keep their draft pick, et cetera. So some sort of variation on that works. As I say, take all the teams who haven't made the playoffs, and put them in a hopper and let one of them come out, or do it in reverse order. So the 14th team gets the first round pick. So, okay, we're not making the playoffs, but let's play hard till the end. So you put incentives in there for winning.
The book is called In Exact Science, The 6 Most Compelling Draft Years in NHL History. Bruce Dobigan, my guest. Before we let you go, Bruce, what is your favorite story in this book?
I like the history again of the Dion and Lafleur draft year and all the things that happened. The two kids from small towns in Quebec, etc. But something people have completely—they don't know about unless you lived through it—was of course, 1971 was still the heart of the FLQ and the tensions in Quebec, etc. And people don't remember, of course, that Marcel Dion, pride of Drummondville, Quebec, went to play in the OHA. And there were a lot of people in Quebec who thought he was a sellout, a vendu. And when St. Catharines, which is, of course, where Dion went, when St. Catharines played the Ramparts with Guy Lafleur, the series was full of tension between the two sides. And in the end, just things happening in the stands, people going to the hotels and harassing the team. In the end, St. Catharines said, "We're not going back to Quebec to finish the series." They basically forfeited the series. Rather than to go back. And it just tells you about how serious those things were at that time. We don't think anything of it now, or maybe you honk a horn outside of a hotel or something, but it just reminded me of being at that period of time. I was in Montreal. I grew up in Montreal, and our mayor lived down the street, and he had a guy with a rifle at the end of his driveway protecting him. It was a different time in Canada, but it was also a major part of the tensions between Dion and Lafleur.
There were, I remember when we did the Memorial Cup and the closing of the Colisée, Oshawa beats Kelowna, but all about that, it was all about, you know, the history of the Memorial Cup and certainly in Quebec as well. And there were kids on that St. Catharines team that, you know, they were threatened that they were going to get stabbed. You know, you better make sure you don't get up in the penalty box. You know, someone's going to jump in and stab you. And these are kids. Yeah. Like, this is junior hockey. Like, it was that type of intensity. And I know that, you know, quitting on the Memorial Cup at that point, you know, certainly frowned upon. But from the kids' point of view, if I'm a parent, I get it. Yeah, I get it. I understand it.
If there's enough time, the other story that's just a great story, of course, is '89. The Red Wings basically reinvent the model for how you can bring in Russian players, etc. One of my favorite stories, of course, is the Red Wings were prepared to take Pavel Bure in that draft too. They had every intention. Some people on the staff, as you probably talked to, of getting Lidstrom, Fedorov, Konstantinov, and then also to maybe be able to get Pavel in the 10th or 11th round. In those days, they had all those extra rounds. And of course, there was this debate about had Pavel played enough games to qualify to be drafted. And the Red Wings, can you imagine how they had a pretty good 25-year run? Can you imagine what they would have had if they'd also had Pavel on that team?
I remember asking Neil Smith about that, who was with the Red Wings at that point, was at the draft table, and he was part of a group that was stumping for Pavel Bure, and Jim Devolano turned to him and said, quote, "Neil, that's enough with the Russians."
Yeah, that's true.
Can you imagine?
He said that too. Well, he was nervous because, you know, it's one thing to fail with drafting a kid from the Windsor Spitfires. If you draft a kid from the tractor team in Russia, he doesn't turn out.
Yeah.
That looks even worse for you. And of course, there was also that thing with Nick Lidstrom. The Red Wings had to prove that Lidstrom had played enough games. And this is where Krister Rockström, of course, who was their scout at the time, he had done some work finding out some games that Lidstrom had played that made him qualify to be drafted in the third round. So there was all sorts of stuff going on in those days, trying to find game sheets of guys who had played enough so that you could draft them.
And I think I think Krister ended up finding Lidstrom. I want to say it was Per Juice, the defenseman they were looking at. That was the guy they were going to scout.
Yeah.
And it was Nicklas Backstrom, the one that they ended up, you know, saying, hang on a second here. I think we really have something. I know we went to go see the Juice kid, but this Nicklas Backstrom fellow is quite something. It's been a lot of fun. The book is called An Exact Science, the 6 Most Compelling Draft Years in NHL History. You don't have to be a fan specifically of the draft to enjoy it. Just a fan of great hockey stories, and the draft is the backdrop. Bruce, thanks so much for this.
Thanks very much, Jeff. I appreciate it. And I hope people get a chance to read it.
It's a good one. And send my best to Evan as well. He does excellent work. Bruce Dobigan, my guest. We will step away. We'll come back. And it's the quarter point of the season. And so as such, me and Maddie Marchese are going to run through our quarter point Hart, Vezina, Norris, Calder, Adams. And if we have time, the surprises and disappointments of the season so far. More of the Merrick Show in moments. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, 960, 650. That is the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to the Jeff Merrick Show. Okay, Matty Marchese, if I wanted to run through, you know, here we are, basically a quarter of the season is done for most teams. Listen, Boston and Colorado still haven't played as many games as everybody else. Time to catch up, crew. But where do you want to start? Like, what do you want to run through? How do you want to do it? You're the producer. Tell me where to go.
Oh, Jeff, don't do that.
I go where I'm put, Matty. I go where I'm put, as they say.
You don't want me to tell you where to go. Let's start with the heart, because I feel like that is – I have a feeling that you went in the same direction as me, but I could be wrong here. Because the way I look at it, it's Leon Draisaitl.
Uh-huh.
And when you look at the season that he's put together – firstly, the fact that he's averaging more than one goal per game with 20 and 19 games, and he's playing over 23 minutes, that to me is a real indication of a special season that we're not talking enough about. He's 55% in the draw. He has the second most even strength points behind Alex Ovechkin. For comparison's sake, Connor McDavid is fourth. He has 18. Draisaitl has 23. And Leon Draisaitl has more primary assists, shockingly enough, than Connor McDavid as well. So I think it's Leon Draisaitl.
Yeah, he's my guy. To me, it's between Leon Draisaitl and Alex Ovechkin. Although, having said that, over the course of the season, I can see by the end it could end up being Connor McDavid very well. I think a low key one here too is Johnny Gaudreau. When you look at what the Calgary Flames have been able to do, tops in the division, and you know, turning everybody's head, and he's doing this in a contract year. Good for Johnny Gaudreau. You know, he's one of the main drivers of one of the top lines in the league with Lindholm and Tkachuk, and one of the top teams in the league in a division that is much improved. Having said that, it's Leon Draisaitl. He is the guy right now in the NHL. And I know the an emergency break glass move for Tippett is to put Draisaitl and McDavid together, and that's always a huge compliment to the team that's playing the Oilers when they have to go to that. But it's not as if, you know, Leon's just getting all of this tethered to Connor McDavid. I'm with you. I'm taking Draisaitl all day long on this one, but I can see it being Connor by season's end.
I read, I can't remember what piece I saw it in, but it was Glenn Gullitson, Oilers assistant coach, and he was talking about this is not his words, this is mine, but basically Leon Draisaitl is a line mate chameleon. So he goes to play with Connor McDavid and he becomes a sniper. But when he's centering his own line, he becomes this playmaker who wins draws and is incredible in his own zone. And I think to have that ability, there's very few guys in the league that can do that kind of thing, Jeff.
Yeah, he's a good hockey player. Not just a good shooter. He's a good hockey player.
In the words of Mike Babcock. Okay,
he's a good hockey player.
He's a good player. Let's go to the Norris next. And okay. I'll let you start with yours because I don't think I went off the board with mine, but it may be a surprise to some out there. So I'll let you start with yours first.
I really wanted to say Miro Heiskanen. And I think by the end, it may end up being Miro Heiskanen, although I still do think it's going to be Cale Makar who I chose. But Heiskanen gets top matchup. Most recently we saw against the Edmonton Oilers, still able to put up points and play offensively. The Dallas Stars haven't had a ton of bright spots in their lineup so far this season, but Heiskanen is clearly one of them and is one of the best defensemen in the NHL. I go Cale Makar on this one, but you have to throw Adam Fox into the conversation. I put Charlie McAvoy in the conversation, and Aaron Ekblad's having an outstanding season for Florida Panthers. And scored the game winner again last night. For the Panthers over the Philadelphia Flyers. Those would be the field that I'm choosing from right now. I'm going to give it to Cale Makar. I don't know that I've seen anyone control from the back end this season better than Cale Makar, but Adam Fox is there, Charlie McAvoy, Aaron Ekblad, and man, I really got all day long for Miro Heiskanen.
I went with Aaron Ekblad. And the one thing that has eluded Aaron Ekblad has been just being able to stay healthy. He always has that one injury that takes him out for a significant period of time. And that's been a killer for him, especially when it comes to the Norris conversation. So this season, fourth in scoring among defensemen, he's playing over 25 minutes a night. I know plus minus isn't the be all end all, but when you're tied for the league lead at plus 17, that's a big deal. He kills penalties. He plays on the first power play unit. And the thing that gets me, Jeff, is he's probably the oldest 25-year-old that I've ever seen.
Dude, he looked like that when he was a 16. No, wait a minute. He was an exceptional status kid. So when he's like 15 playing with the Barrie Colts, he's always looked like that. He's looked like that since he joined the OHL. I remember looking at him and going like, this kid's 25.
Yeah. And
he has not aged one bit. Honestly, Maddie, trust me. He's always looked like that.
But even just the fact that he's 25 and it feels like he's been in the league for 15 years. Right, because he's been a really good player. He just hasn't, you know, and playing in Florida doesn't help him. But I think this season is where we finally see, like, okay, Aaron Ekblad is and this isn't for the hardcore hockey people, but for the casual hockey fan, because Florida is really good as they were last year. They're finally going to go, hey, I remember this guy. Oh yeah, he's playing in Florida. Oh wow, he's really good. That's how I kind of feel about Aaron Ekblad this year.
He's good. He's good. All right, Cats are on top. What else?
Let's go to the Vezina. And I know you gave out a list earlier when we were talking with Jim Ralph. And the guy that you mentioned for me is the Vezina Trophy winner at this point in the season, Jack Campbell. He's got the best goals against average and save percentage among goalies who have started 10 or more games. He's tied for the league lead with 11 wins. And for me, he's been the best player. Like, he's had a couple of off nights, but he's been the best Leaf player from the beginning of the season to this point. And, you know, we talk about Jacob Markstrom's 5 shutouts. Jack Campbell's got 3. And 5 of Jack Campbell's 11 wins are in 1-goal games. So I think that is another indicator of Jack Campbell's performance and being able to play in maybe not high-pressure situations, but close games and keeping his team ahead.
So I think the best goaltender of all time, the goaltender that had the most effect on his team, the goaltender that directly contributed wins to a team that didn't deserve them, is Dominik Hasek, who played on a lot of teams that leaked chances over and over and over again. And Dominik Hasek was there to bail them out. So in that spirit, I'm taking Igor Shesterkin of the New York Rangers, because as we know about the Rangers, is they surrender a ton of chances and they're comfortable doing so. They think they can outscore teams so far, by and large, they have. Look at Chris Kreider, goals number 14 and 15 last night. Here's why I'm going to go with Shesterkin. Amongst the league leaders in save percentage, he stops, I think it's the most percentage-wise high danger chances of any goaltender in the NHL. If he's not number one, he's certainly in that mix. And if you look at the numbers that his backup has, again, the two goaltenders are playing in front of the same team. Georgiev's numbers are really poor because stylistically, the Rangers give up a ton. With Shesterkin, that's fine. With Georgiev, that's not. Now, Markstrom's had an outstanding performance. I wonder how much of it is undone because of the defensive posture of the team. I asked the same thing of Jack Campbell. I think you can throw Bobrovsky into that mix. I think Freddie Anderson's been exceptional for the Carolina Hurricanes. Low-key Robin Leonard has had a really good campaign for the Vegas Golden Knights. But no one, based on how the team in front of him plays and how he performs despite them leaking chances, nobody performs better for my money than Igor Shesterkin. So I'll take the Rangers goalie for the Vezina.
Let the jury know that Jeff also selected Igor Shesterkin as his Vezina trophy winner in the preseason thing that he had to do for Sportsnet. So,
but hang on a second. I wasn't voting for Carter Hart for the Vezina by the end of last season. That was my pick last year. So like, put a leash on that puppy, okay? Put a leash on that pup.
I do agree with you on Shesterkin, though. And the one thing about Shesterkin is there are goalies that when you watch them, they're very they play the position very well. Positionally, they are very good. But there are also fun goalies to watch. Like, Shesterkin is a fun goalie to watch because sometimes he puts himself in situations where he's like, he probably shouldn't be there, and he still makes the save. I think that's what I enjoy about him so much. It's not Dominic Hasek-esque, but it's along that same line. Like, he makes saves he probably shouldn't make, and the fact that he gets so many shots makes him very exciting to watch as well. Let's go to the Calder Trophy. I went with Lucas Raymond. I think he's performed.
How do you not?
Exactly.
How do you not?
Exactly. I really did think about Moritz Seider, though, just because of how he's played the position at such a young age, because we've seen how defensemen do some. Now, special defensemen don't take as long. Cale Makar would be a great example of that. But on a team that there isn't a lot expected from, for a 20-year-old defenseman to come in and have the impact that he has, I'm almost talking myself into Mo Sider right now, but he's been great. But with Lucas Raymond, 20 points in 21 games, 15 of them have come at even strength. He's playing almost 17 minutes a night. He's 19 years old, and he had a little bit of a slow start, but he's looked really good over the past few weeks to the point where you look at him and go, he doesn't even look like a rookie anymore.
Yeah, he's the pick. There's him, and then there's the field right now. But there's someone I want to pull out of the field that I think has a shot at this if he continues to perform like this. And it's not Mo Sider, although I love Mo Sider. There's a lot of reasons that it's fun to watch the Red Wings these days. Dawson Mercer with New Jersey turning heads. You had a chance to watch the Devils, folks. Watch out for Mercer. He's been exceptional. Trevor Zegras in Anaheim. I think by the end of the season, he's going to be very much in the conversation. He already is. But the one guy that I'm going to pull out here, in the beginning of the season, I think Elliott took Spencer Knight. But Spencer Knight was one of the players that people looked at and said, okay, if it's not going to be Cole Caulfield, because everybody's given the Calder to Cole Caulfield, it could be Spencer Knight with the Florida Panthers. Bobrovsky has grabbed the number one job there, and he's not letting go of it anytime soon. The guy that I want to pull out here has only played 4 games in the NHL. Do you know who that is?
When you were talking about it, I couldn't figure it out, Jeff, because you're like, it's not going to be this guy. And they're like, oh, okay, then it's got to be Dawson Mercer. And he's like, it's not going to be Dawson Mercer. I'm like, okay, I don't know who it is, Jeff. So I'm flummoxed right now.
Hang on a second here. Maybe I'm thinking, how many games do you have to have played do you still qualify as a rookie? Is it 25?
I think so.
Okay, then maybe he doesn't qualify. So let's go with Jake Oettinger of the Dallas Stars. He may have played because he played 29 games in 2021. Does he qualify as a rookie anymore?
I'm gonna check right now.
Check that because it's clearly Lucas Raymond going away. If Jake Oettinger is not a rookie, but is it 25 games for rookie status? If it's not, then Jake Oettinger.
I'm looking right now. It doesn't look like he qualifies.
Then that sucks.
At least that's what I'm seeing right now. That's on the NHL website. It doesn't come up when you look up rookie goalie stats, so I don't think he's there. However, I do think that Jake Ottinger is going to have a good year.
29, he doesn't qualify then, because that was a guy that I was going to pull out here, but the 29 stands out. But then it's Lucas Raymond going away.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
It's Lucas Raymond versus the field right now. What else we have?
All right, let's go to the Jack Adams Trophy. I'll let you go first here.
There's a lot. Evason Sutter, Brendan Moore, Keith Sullivan, Aikens. Right now, despite the fact that they've hit a little bit of a speed wobble, I'll go with Dallas Aikens. It's what he's been able to do, and again, there have been some great performances and high shooting percentages from people like Troy Terry, for example, but some great play from John Gibson, but show me a good goalie and I'll show you a good coach. I think what Dallas Aikens has been able to do with the Anaheim Ducks is nothing short of outstanding. Taking the Anaheim Ducks, I mean, that was a team we thought was going to be in the conversation for Shane Wright at the end of the season. I'll take Aikens in a really tough field so far. I mean, Brendan Moore, when you consider all the players that the New Jersey Devils have lost, led by Dougie Hamilton, and they've still been able to keep, you know, the top spot in their division. Sheldon Keefe's keeping the Maple Leafs up there. Mike Sullivan has been pounded by injuries and COVID. Daryl Sutter has taken the Calgary Flames to first overall in the Pacific. Dean Evason keeps Minnesota up on top. But I'll take Dallas Aikens, a team that many people wrote off at the beginning of the season and has taken them into a playoff conversation. I'll take the coach in Anaheim. What about you?
All right. I went with Daryl Sutter. And part of the reason why there wasn't a ton of changeover on that team. They did lose Mark Giordano. They brought in Dan Vladar. We've just seen this team play a different style. And I know that Daryl Sutter is a very defensive-minded coach, but this team has a plus 30 goal differential, which is tops in the NHL. And they also have a 9-2-2 away record. We've also seen him seemingly press the right buttons with Johnny Gaudreau, Elias Lindholm, and Andrew Mangiapane. So, I mean, there are a lot of good names. I would agree with you. For me, Daryl Sutter stands out because I just, like Dallas Aikens, I just didn't expect a whole heck of a lot from this team because we've seen what this group has done in the past and it hasn't been much.
That's good. We did get to surprises and disappointments, but we'll do that tomorrow on the program. Listen, thanks for joining me today. Much appreciated as always. I want to thank Elliot Friedman as always for stopping by to kick off the show. Jim Ralph, Maple Leafs radio analyst, and Bruce Dobigan, author of Inexact Science, the 6 most compelling draft years in NHL history. It's hockey book season, folks. That's one of them. Hoping to get Brian McFarlane on the program soon to talk about his newest offering about his time in hockey. Thanks for joining me. Merrick Show continues tomorrow as we wrap up another week and look forward to the weekend.